Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. In the wake of the targeted massacre in Norway, we will begin with an analysis of the relationship between the resurgence of far-right extremism and political violence. Jonathan Birdwell, a researcher on the Violence and Extremism Program at Demos in London, joins us to discuss how the extreme right in Europe has not only become more palatable, but they have already exerted a gravitational pull on the centre, with British Prime Minister Cameron and German Chancellor Merkel both recently proclaiming the death of multiculturalism. Then we'll examine further the rise of the radical right and Christian fundamentalism here in the United States with Frank Schaeffer, the son of one of the founders of the religious right. He will discuss the dangerous notion pervasive on the religious right amongst Christian fundamentalists and some Tea Party activists that equates godliness with a hatred of government. Then finally, we'll talk about a nuclear-armed country at war with itself, Pakistan. Washington Post correspondent Pamela Constable, the author of a new book, Playing with Fire, joins us to talk about a country she has reported on extensively, one that is riddled with corruption, devastated by natural disasters, and terrorized by Islamic extremists. Joining us now is Jonathan Birdwell, who is a researcher specializing in counterterrorism, public behavior, and drug policy at Demos. He is the co-author of the article now out in Foreign Policy called Rise of the Radical Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Birdwell.
Thank you very much for having me.
The study that you've done for Demos and written about, of course, in Foreign Policy suggests that things in Europe are far more dangerous than anyone thinks. Is that a fair way to characterize your work?
I think that is fair. I should say that our research is still ongoing. We're actually more than just over halfway through doing the research. Now, that research is looking at the rise of the far right. In particular, we're looking at street-based movements, and we're looking across Europe. We're doing a survey of far-right activists as well as sympathizers, and only halfway through, we have 6,000 responses on that. And we are also going to 6 different European countries to interview far-right members face-to-face. And just this week, before the Norway attacks, I was in Copenhagen, actually, in Denmark, interviewing far-right activists and leaders. So we're still in the process of doing this research, but I would say absolutely that we've seen in the past couple years the growth of far-right activity. And it's been a concern. It's been a growing concern, particularly in the UK. But obviously, the attacks in Norway kind of take it to the next level. I don't think anyone was prepared for these kind of terrorist attacks. But if you look at the rhetoric, the inflammatory rhetoric that is pervasive among far-right groups, as well as far-right political parties that have gained power, I think it was only a matter of time that some individual was going to take the next step into violence.
And Jonathan Birdwell, the judge in Norway heard closed testimony and revealed that Breivik had claimed that some contact with other cells. You're suggesting in the Foreign Policy article that he may well have had contact with Britain's, the English Defence League, which is a far-right group in England. Anything developing on that?
Well, they've been reporting that. The latest is, so in his manifesto, Breivik claims to have met members of the EDL when it was in its, and even to have advised members of the EDL and leaders of the EDL in their kind of early phases. Now, the EDL leadership has, you know, vociferously contested this, but the EDL, the English Defense League, is an organization that is quite loose. It has, on Facebook, say, 72,000 members. So, inevitably, and a lot of these members are very active on internet chat forums. So I think it's absolutely inevitable that Breivik had conversations with EDL members. The extent to which he was in contact with the leaders of the organization, that, so far, we don't know. We will just have to wait and see, really. But I know the police are in the UK are very interested in this. In particular, he makes mention to a meeting that happened way back in April 2002 of this group that he claims to be a member of, the Knights Templar, in London, and he even claims that one of his kind of mentors is English. So there are definitely hints at connections between the two, but I think it is very important to bear in mind that the EDL is quite a large organization, so it's obviously very difficult for the leadership to keep an eye on the contacts of every single individual member.
But Jonathan Birdwell, tell me about the Knights Templar. Does it exist? Has anybody done any legwork on that?
You know, that is really one of the most fascinating things for me as a researcher of this, because up until now, I haven't heard anything about the Knights Templar. I mean, obviously, they're a medieval organization associated with the Crusades. Now, in our research, we often come across extremist groups, especially on the right, who are kind of enmeshed in conspiracy theories involving, you know, Zionist occupied governments, a new world order, and they often do include organizations like the Freemasons and Knights Templar. So it's actually really fascinating to see someone who is also on the far right, but who is a stated member of these organizations. He claims to be a member. So I have not come across the Knights Templar as a far right group thus far. But I think, obviously, now the spotlight is on them. So we shall see what information comes up in the next couple of weeks.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Birdwell, who is a researcher specializing in counterterrorism and far-right political groups in Europe at Demos. He's the co-author of the article now out on foreignpolicy.com called Rise of the Radical Right. One of the things that I find disturbing is that in this extensive manifesto that Breivik has written, posting it an hour or so before the massacre that he carried out, he mentions that he went to Prague to get hold of a phony police badge that he wore on this uniform to fool the police on the island and be able to kill them and then start massacring these young Labour Party youth leaders, striking a blow, a very politically aimed blow at this particular political party. What is the Eastern European connection here? Because the Jobbik Party in Hungary is growing, and of course the Eastern European countries, of course, in many were sympathetic to the Nazis and to the occupiers. So give me a sense of that. We all know that there is little to no sympathy for the Quislings, the Nazi occupiers from World War II, I mean the Nazi collaborators in World War II, and that thus the right in Norway is pretty small. As I imagine it is in Denmark because of the legacy of World War II. Am I correct in that?
You are correct. I mean, I wouldn't say it's non-existent at all. And in Denmark especially, you know, there are a handful of quite fringe groups, some that have Nazi connotations, others that are trying to disassociate themselves from Nazi connotations. But in our field work, we heard that actually in Sweden, which was not occupied during World War II, you have a much larger Nazi group contingent because of that. Now, the Eastern European connection is absolutely very interesting. And unfortunately, as I said, we're still only halfway through our research. But we are surveying far-right members in Eastern Europe. We're planning to go to Hungary as well. And there is a rise, similar as it is in Western Europe, there's also a rise in Eastern Europe, which you might think is surprising because they have far fewer numbers in terms of Muslim immigration to Eastern Europe, which is, of course, has been the kind of the catalyst for the rise of far-right groups in Western Europe. But it's definitely on the rise in Eastern Europe as well, in Hungary, in Bulgaria. When we started out on this research, we spoke with contacts that we had who were affiliated with the English Defense League as part of our research, and they said, look east. So I think there is definitely a huge need to look more closely at the rise of this phenomenon in Eastern Europe as well as Western Europe.
Well, it would seem, though, that what is disturbing is that over the last decade, the extreme right in Europe has become more palatable, and I suppose that's to some extent reinforced by recent statements from British Prime Minister David Cameron and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, both announcing the death of multiculturalism, and that Nicolas Sarkozy's banning of the burqa has certainly given him a boost in the polls in France. So to what extent is the horse out of the barn and down the paddock, as they say?
It's very interesting. And you know, you have seen the growth of far-right political parties gaining votes, gaining power in France, in Denmark, in Sweden, in Italy, in Hungary. And because these fringe groups are having such success, I think that is exerting, as we say in the article, and it's exerting a kind of gravitational pull on the center so that mainstream politicians like David Cameron, like Angela Merkel, like Nicolas Sarkozy, are adopting, are beginning to say the same things about pointing out the downsides of immigration, as you said, declaring that multiculturalism is dead. And I think they have to walk a very, very fine line, because clearly this is an issue that concerns a lot of people, and therefore mainstream politicians have to talk about it so as to take the oxygen away from those on the fringes. But at the same time, they have to do so in a very measured and conscious way so as not to fan the flames of far-right groups and individuals, but to show the broader constituency and population that these are issues that mainstream politicians aren't ignoring. I think that's really important.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Birdwell, who is a researcher with Demos, where he specializes in counterterrorism and right-wing political groups, which he's investigating in the midst of doing a comprehensive investigation across Europe, and in not just Western Europe, but Eastern Europe as well, as he's just mentioned. He's the co-author of the article out now in foreignpolicy.com called Rise of the Radical Right. There are, of course, when we were talking earlier about the Knights Templar and trying to figure out whether it's a figment of Breivik's imagination or whether it's a real phenomenon, the, harking back, of course, to the Crusades has paradoxical echoes of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. But there is, of course, an anti-immigrant website here and a group here in the United States led by a fellow called Spence, which calls itself the Gates of Vienna, which is, of course, a reference to how far Muslims encroached into Europe during the Middle Ages.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So what do you know about the American the American element here?
I think throughout the manifesto, he cites a number of people that are described as the kind of counter-jihad. In addition to the Gates of Vienna website, there's the Jihad Watch website run by Robert Spencer, there's Daniel Pipes, there's the other woman who made such a fuss about the mosque down near Ground Zero.
Pamela Geller, yes.
Exactly, yes. And obviously the narrative of these individuals is something that Anders Breivik, you know, subscribes to wholly. Now, I don't think, obviously, that's not to say that they're responsible. They don't advocate violence. But I think they do need to accept some responsibility for the way in which they talk about these issues. And the rhetoric they use. And these individuals, you know, are constantly heaping blame on conservative Muslim imams who don't advocate violence, but who they think provide an ideology which inevitably leads to violence. So I think they need to consider their own position and recognize that the logic applies on the other way as well. So they are providing the infrastructure for individuals who might go off and do absolutely horrendous violent actions like Anders Breivik.
Well, Jonathan Birdwell, Daniel Pipes, who was mentioned in Breivik's manifesto as being somebody that supports this notion that Christians have to fight back against this Islamic onslaught. And so much of the rhetoric over here in the political right and the Tea Party right of the Republican Party, fueled by people like Robert Spencer and Pamela Geller and Daniel Pipes, is frankly bordering on the ludicrous. Many states in the Midwest and other places have, in fact, passed laws banning Sharia law, which is never on the table. Talk about being proactive against a myth. But you can't dismiss somebody like a Daniel Pipes, because he was appointed by George W. Bush to head up the United States Institute of Peace, which is funded by the United States and set up by the United States Congress. It's quite a prestigious organization.
Yeah. Well, I won't question the wisdom of that. Had appointment, but
well, you wouldn't. You're not going to question the wisdom.
There are legitimate concerns, probably, that people have about immigration and radical Islam, and especially in the U.S., where although it has quite a high population of Muslims, not many people, especially in the Midwest, probably interact with Muslims, and a lot of what they see on the media is this stuff about it's just kind of scaremongering. So you know, I'm not saying that everything that he says is problematic. Or wrong, I'm just saying that he needs to, and others like him, need to apply the same logic that they do when it comes to al-Qaeda-inspired terrorism and what they call Islamists to the way in which they speak about what they see as a legitimate concern. They should not be using inflammatory rhetoric that gives people a sense of there is an existential crisis and a coming, you know, clash of civilizations. Because that's it's just... It's just not the case.
But I think what is the case, at least what you're arguing in your article, The Rise of the Radical Right, at foreignpolicy.com, Jonathan Birdwell, is that we've had plenty of examples recently of this notion that mainstream politicians are spineless, soft-boiled, I'm quoting from the article, spineless, soft-boiled, venal, self-serving slaves to political correctness and orthodoxy. That is exactly what Breivik has been was motivated to do. He believed that the ruling party in Norway were selling the country out to Marxism and political correctness, or a Marxist version of political correctness. But you cite examples of the banking bailout, which of course helped form the Tea Party over here, the Eurozone crisis, and the more recent News International hacking scandal, which showed how much politicians were in the pocket of this media baron and how they were cravenly manipulated by him and sought, groveled before him, if you will. And so explain that further, because it seems to me that these feelings are fairly universally felt, but I guess on the far right, they take it a little further.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think you're seeing across the board a disillusionment towards the establishment, and a disillusionment obviously driving the Tea Party into mainstream politicians, who they see as, you know, as I said, venal, and ignoring the concerns of the common person. And I think, you know, a lot of this is the pressures of globalization. You know, a lot of, not everyone is going to come out on top as globalization continues. And it's up to politicians to frame that and explain that to individuals so that they don't have a complete loss of trust in our institutions and our representative leaders. Now, it is definitely more pronounced, or what it is pronounced, certainly among far-right groups. And what is really interesting that we've seen a little bit of in Denmark is that you have these formal political parties, these far-right parties, gaining ground and getting into power. And yet, as soon as they do that, they're not acting as a representative for these fringe groups. As soon as these, what we would say, far-right political parties are gaining power, the fringes are viewing them as sellouts, because they're talking about integration rather than repatriation, so sending all immigrants back. So you inevitably have this paradox where you think, well, how do we prevent violent individuals like Anders Breivik? Well, maybe they need representation within governments. But actually what we've seen so far is that even when far-right groups are in governments, that's not enough. That's not a kind of... that doesn't act as a kind of safety valve or pressure, release of a pressure valve for those who might be more inclined to do even more extreme and violent actions.
The Tea Party over here, of course, was formed in response to what happened on Wall Street, and it has become the tail that wags the dog with the Republican Party, and they're behind this economic hostage crisis we have here, where the full faith and credit of the United States is possibly up for grabs while they try and extort concessions from the president. So this is a major power play from this minority far right wing group. And what's, I think, interesting about the connections to the Norwegian mass murderer Breivik is that he was a member of the Norwegian Progress Party, which has a very similar history to the Tea Party. It started out as an anti-tax party and then segued into an anti-immigrant party.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of similarities across countries of the formation of these far-right parties. And then obviously, you know, you can't, as with the Tea Party, you know, there are many different shades to the Tea Party, many people within the Tea Party that have different views, and it's the same within the Progress Party in Norway. But I think it's also the fringe groups that we really need to worry about. Those, I mean, actually with Breivik, you know, he did participate in the political mainstream and then went back out on the fringes and still was motivated to do this violence. So I think the next decade, we're really going to see a rise of far-right activity, of anti-immigrant kind of politics, and it's quite troubling, frankly.
Well, Jonathan Birdwell, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Birdwell, who's a researcher specializing in counterterrorism and far-right political groups. He is with Demos in the United Kingdom. He's also the co-author of the article now out on foreignpolicy.com called Rise of the Radical Right. We're going to be taking a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the rise of the far right here in the United States.
Well, I'm going to tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists, bound to lose.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Frank Schaefer, who is a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Ida Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Frank Schaefer, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. Frank Schaefer's novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, and his latest, Sex, Mom, and God. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Schaefer.
Hey, thanks, Ian.
And clearly, given that this fellow Breivik, in the mass murderer in Norway, in his manifesto cited a number of figures here in America, many of them associated with the phony controversy over the Ground Zero Mosque, Pamela Geller, and Daniel Pipes, the head of the United States Institute for Peace, Robert Spence of Jihad Watch. Actually, I think in the last interview I got him confused with some other fellow that has the gates of Vienna. But the long and the short of it is some pretty creepy people are coming out of the woodwork. And I imagine being cited by a mass murderer is a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, you know, I think that the big issue here is less the individuals he cites, because, you know, he plagiarized a big chunk of Kaczynski's manifesto and changed a few words and made it his, and he talks about Christian Zionism and all the rest of it. I think the real story here is the overall context, the overarching similarity. Look, if you took his manifesto and you stripped out the loony bits about the Templar Knights and the Crusades and all the rest of it, and you just put his view of immigration or his view of homosexuality or his view of women's rights, or his view of Zionism and who should be on the West Bank and what should happen to the Palestinians, and you used it as a template and just laid it over the grid of what most Tea Partiers say they believe, or Michelle Bachmann says she believes, or the Republican Party stands for these days since it's been taken over by the religious right, I think the real story is the overarching context would be a match. Now, that doesn't mean in any way that I'm implying blame to either individual authors or politicians who would genuinely, from their heart, abhor what he did, but I am saying that the temper of the times we live in seems to me to indicate that the extreme action he took really comes out of a milieu which is a much bigger picture of xenophobia, homophobia, misogyny, Zionism run rampant, in terms of the Christian community, people like John Hagee and this big church in Houston, you know, calling essentially for the elimination of the Palestinians in the Holy Land, perhaps not literal elimination, but certainly pushing them out of the borders. That's the context. So, you know, when you look at the actions of a mass murderer, and if it's a Ted Bundy or a Hillside Strangler, whomever, that's one kind of thing. If you look at a senseless act of, you know, random car bombing by the Islamic jihadists, that's another kind of thing. This murder is something different. It's a very specific political act, deliberately fomented to try to generate race war And it's something that has been well thought out and planned for years and has a manifesto attached to it. And its context is not in a vacuum. His views don't stand out like a sore thumb. His views would fit in with run-of-the-mill right-wing Christian views on almost every issue, both in America and Europe. So that's the shocker to me. It isn't that he quotes this or that person. The shocker is that the context of this killing is a political act which gives, you might say, in a horrible way, flesh and blood to what for so many people is just talk, but is drawn from the same vile cesspool of reaction and bigotry as what we would now call mainstream movements. And I hate to put it this way, mainstream to the point that these are the views of the Republican Party, not on killing, but on foreigners, on immigration, and all the rest of it. I think that's the shocker. The shocker is just this general context to me.
Well, Frank Schaefer, you don't have to go that far in the sense that ascribing criticizing your accuracy, but I'm just saying that that you don't even have to go that far with the Republican Party now captured by the Tea Party to see this extraordinary economic hostage crisis that they're pulling off in Washington, D.C., where they're risking the full faith and credit of the United States. They're prepared to bring the whole house down, having a political tantrum, trying to extort concessions so that they get 100% of their way. By any definition, extreme behavior.
Yeah, and what you see there is, you know, something that I was writing about on a piece that I did for Alternet this week, and was repeating again today with Martin Bashir on MSNBC, and that is that when you look at what's happening with the Republicans in Congress today, what you are looking at is faith-based politics. This is not about economics. It's not even about politics. It is about a religious conviction on the fact that, from their point of view, the U.S. government is illegitimate because it has not followed their moral teachings on everything from abortion to women's rights, to education, to gay rights. And the agenda of the Republican Party now, with people like Michelle Bachmann in the fore, or Rick Perry in Texas calling his prayer meeting on August 6th, is an agenda that, again, if you're looking for overlaps and a pair of spectacles to look at this through, the only pair of glasses that really works to understand what the Republicans are doing in Congress tonight is the Ayatollahs in Iran, and that is, it's a kind of a theocratic view of the world. So from their point of view, the U.S. government is evil because it no longer represents what they would call Judeo-Christian values at every turn. It has to be defunded, starve the beast, as Ronald Reagan put it way back when. And their viewpoint is not one of trying to do what's good for the United States of America, much less the world economy, or to get very personal, you know, my pension and savings and yours. They are jihadists in their own way, and that is, it's a scorched earth policy. It's my way or the highway, and they will take us all with them. And when you add race into this, and too few people tell the honest truth on this, the heat and fire in the Tea Party and the Republicans today, from my point of view, over half of it doesn't even come from politics. It's just the anger that they have at seeing a black man more intelligent than they are, more articulate and certainly more compassionate, sitting in the White House. This kind of entitled white man's club has been changed. When you add that mix in, you know, they are carrying out with religious fervor and conviction what Rush Limbaugh said before Obama even took office, and that is, I hope he fails. And they've done everything they can to destroy his presidency. And what amazes me about Obama is that he's managed to get anything done when he faces an opposition that has nothing to do with politics and everything to do with religious conviction about the direction of this country and trying to replace the Constitution and the Bill of Rights with what they would view as God's law on things like abortion, women's rights, gay rights, but even international policy, where they feel they can fight wars of choice based on lies, for instance, in Iraq, and they're entitled to do this because of their conviction about American exceptionalism. Somehow we're special. The rules don't apply to us. So touch it where you may, the Republican Party is in the hands of extremists. And even people like David Brooks, who's a conservative, middle-of-the-road Republican commentator for the New York Times as their commentator from the right, as they would see it, you know, he writes a few weeks ago that the Republican Party can no longer be considered a normal political party, that it has become something else. It's not even a political party anymore, and that's how far it's gone. If you can get David Brooks to essentially read you out of normal politics and call you something abnormal. You've really managed to do something here, and that's what the Tea Party has brought us to.
Again, I'm speaking with Frank Schaefer, the author of Sex, a Mom, and God. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked for such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. He, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. Now, just in terms, though, of the specifics of the anti-Muslim stuff, going back to the Ground Zero Mosque phony controversy, which is about as phony as the debt crisis is, and as much as it was ginned up for political reasons. And of course, Rupert Murdoch's New York Post fanned the flames. Those people, as we mentioned, have been cited by the Norwegian mass killer. But there's one Republican candidate, by the way, who I think fits the bill in terms of this Islamophobia and these outrageous racist statements that are fanning the flames of interfaith tensions, and that is Herman Cain.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, he's not alone. Look, there's two kinds of Republican leadership today. Cain is one, Bachman is one, and then there are the other people who, you know, are quote-unquote mainstream. But listen, when you are... Look, it's a degree of hostage-taking. The whole country has been taken hostage by the Republican Party. That's simply true. The Republican Party has been taken hostage by the religious right. And in the Republican Party, there's two kinds of Republicans with a lot of gray ones, you know, undefined in the middle, but two on the extreme. One is, you know, the good old boys club that don't care at all about the social issues or even the Republican agenda. They're just in the pocket of the Koch brothers and et cetera, et cetera. Those guys, you know, would not let the Tea Partiers even caddy for them on their golf club if they ever actually met one in the flesh. But they have to play along because the primary-based election system in this country for politics means that they will be primaried on state level or national level and beaten by this vociferous group of people who have taken over the party. So what the Tea Party has done to the Republican Party is now doing to the whole country. And they're doing it on two levels. One, the true believers like Bachman and Cain, and then secondly, or Rick Perry, and then secondly, the people who are not true believers, and it's just business as usual, but they have to use these rubes, as they would think of the Tea Partiers, to get what they want in the primaries, and then they go on, and when they're elected, of course, they do nothing on any of their issues. What they do is they simply take care of their billionaires club and make sure that their friends aren't paying taxes. And those are that's what's left of the Republican Party. You know, Bill Buckley, roll over in your grave. Or former John McCain, you know, look in the mirror and apologize. I mean, the Republican Party, agree or disagree, was not always in the hands of a combination of extremists and Rand groupies and Bible-thumping fundamentalists on the one hand, and people who had no interest or agenda other than taking care of their billionaire stock traders. That's where it's come to.
Well, Frank Schaefer, I know that you're concerned, and you see an analogy here with the Norwegian mass murderer in terms of similar currents here in the United States, in as much as the religious right and Christian fundamentalists here in the United States equate godliness with hatred of government. And
sure.
And that is, I think, a subject that's worth exploring. And furthermore, when you talk about abortion and the so-called pro-life movement, which it ends up being corrupted to the point where you have killers of abortion providers like the killer of Dr. Frank Tiller a couple of years back. And so the thing that I find particularly disturbing about that phenomenon is that it's ultimately about a moral free ride. It means that you can actually care passionately about, for example, about the life of a fetus, which, you know, pro-life is a much more powerful concept than pro-choice. It gets to the heart of a deep emotional and moral truth. So, but at the same time, the idea that because you care so much about unborn babies, that gives you the right to kill another human being, in this case, in his own church, is sort of, I think, I'm not trying to make a reach here, is kind of the mentality of this guy that went out and killed these kids, because he thought that he had a higher calling that sanctioned the killing of these kids. So How do you go that extra step from being a legitimate pro-life activist and killing an abortion provider?
Well, I think you've outlined it very well, and it's not an accident that in my new book, Sex, Mom, and God, I take two chapters and really unpack both the history, the direction, and what happened to the so-called pro-life movement. Look, it would not have started without my dad and I working on these things back in the 70s, not in terms of a Protestant pro-life movement, and then we teamed up with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who then became Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General, and so forth and so on. And so in this area, I was on the inside, and I think I know what I'm talking about, and try to explain how this became a watershed movement. But the thing that you said is absolutely true. Look, if you have a basic religious or moral conviction that you are completely right and everybody is completely wrong on an issue and there are no gray areas, and then you go the next step and you demonize your opponents so they are no longer rational people that you can disagree with, discuss with, perhaps learn from, who might even change your mind on something if they present an argument. They are just the other. They are demonic. They are wicked. You see, that's what's happened, and that transfer has been made to the whole U.S. government. The pro-life so-called community does not regard the U.S. government as legitimate. They regard it as illegitimate, or to put it in the words of my father, Francis Schaeffer, in his book, A Christian Manifesto, the U.S. government is the same as Hitler's Germany. And he said that because of his views of abortion. Well, as soon as you've said that, you know, if your president is like Hitler, if your government's like Hitler, what does that open the door to doing? You know, firebombing cities, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. I mean, where would the limit be to get rid of this evil if that's how you have delegitimized your own country, your own government? So when these people talk about being anti-government, you have to understand that in the context of a democracy, that means they are anti-American. That means they hate their country, and they do. They like a fictionalized America where there would be no gay people, no immigrants. Everyone would live the way they do. You know, they would be in homeschools with their children or small Christian academies. There would be no public education. That's the America they love, and they try to create it on an individual basis. The rest of us, you know, to put it in Sarah Palin's words, are not real Americans, and she and her followers would be real Americans. So when you get to that point, when your opponent is no longer human, but someone who is illegitimate simply because they hold views you disagree with, and therefore, you know, they don't exist on the same level you do, you can kill them, and that's where abortion provider murders do their acts. That's why this guy drove his plane into an IRS building. He so hated the government. This is why the Houthi militia was training to kill policemen. I mean, think about that. The right wing is supposed to be all about, you know, cops and flags and you know, young Marines and the rest of it. The Houthi militia, in the name of Jesus, was training to kill American service people in order to hasten the apocalypse. And we've got secessionist movements running around the country in the woods, you know, training with automatic weapons. What for? Well, for Second Amendment remedies.
We've also got very likely that the governor of Texas, a secessionist, will be running for president. I'm afraid we've run out of time here, Frank Schaeffer, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it's always my pleasure, Ian. Thanks a lot.
Again, I've been speaking with Frank Schaeffer, author of Sex, Mom, and God. Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the author of Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself.
Your diamonds, and you've got your pretty clothes, and the chauffeur drives your car. You let everybody know, but don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Pamela Constable, author of the new book, Playing with Fire: Pakistan at War with Itself. Pamela Constable is a foreign correspondent and former deputy foreign editor of the Washington Post, where she has covered South Asia from New Delhi to Kabul. Her other books include Fragments of Grace, My Search for Meaning in the Strife of South Asia, and A Nation of Enemies, Chile under Pinochet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pamela Constable.
Glad to be here, and nice to hear Mick Jagger.
Well, I think you got the joke there, didn't you? The musical pun, Playing with Fire. I don't know where to begin, Pamela Constable. I mean, every day there's in the press there's bad news, the latest about Pakistan, I should say. The latest of which is, I think, and I know there's some massacres going on or mass murders going on in Karachi, political violence there. But just in the last few weeks, it was a couple of Pakistani businessmen were indicted for funneling ISI, intelligence money into U.S. congressmen, mostly Dan Burton. So do you feel sometimes that it's unyielding, the problems and criticism of Pakistan?
Well, there's certainly relentless news coming out of Pakistan, which is one of the things that makes it very difficult to write a book about a situation that is so fluid and so evolving and that keeps producing new incidents and problems that you feel you really have to keep up with. And it was very difficult to actually complete this book. In fact, it was completed just before Osama bin Laden was killed. So it really you tear your hair out trying to make sense of it all. But yes, to answer your question seriously, sometimes you do feel as if there are just so many problems and so many criticisms and so many tensions. You're looking for something positive to say, and I do have some positive things to say in the book, but I'm afraid they are, at least for now, outweighed by some of the negatives.
So when you talk about Pakistan at war with itself, of course you're talking about a nuclear-powered country, or nuclear-armed country, I should say, that in fact, my understanding is it's the fastest-growing nuclear arsenal in the world. It has, by some analyses, passed the number of warheads France has, and it's creeping up on the number of warheads that Britain has.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on nuclear policy or issues. The war that I'm really talking about in Pakistan has to do with more, you know, religious and political differences and tensions that are creating enormous difficulties in what is one of the largest and will soon be the largest Muslim country in the world, a country which has a history of moderate and tolerant views of Islam, but which is increasingly being influenced by much more radical and violent visions of Islam. And that's the war that I focus on and that I find of great concern.
But surely just the recent killing of Osama bin Laden raised some very disturbing possibilities. Number one was that the people at the top in the military and the ISI knew about it. That's been discounted by our political and military leaders. The second possibility is that people down the chain knew about it and sheltered him and perhaps saw him as some kind of an asset. And the third possibility is that nobody knew anything, which nobody believes. So if you take that second possibility, it does relate to nuclear weapons because it raises questions about command and control.
Well, that is true. And you know, the Pakistani authorities, military and civilian, have always stressed every time this issue was raised that they have firm control over the nuclear arsenal, that they would never use it irresponsibly, and that this is something that no one needs to worry about. In fact, they often say they're worried about their nuclear assets being stolen by the West and its agents. But the problem increasingly, or the concern increasingly, is that people who are not officially part of the state, people who are who wield power and influence in other arenas, including militant Islamist groups, which may have maybe some covert support or winked at by the state but are not officially supported, could in fact possibly get access to that arsenal. And I think that's the greater concern.
And again, I'm speaking with Pamela Constable, author of the new book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. And of course, the book is largely about the people of Pakistan, their aspirations and their sense of being trapped in a country. There's a pervasive joke that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And it does seem that the choices for the average Pakistani are pretty dismal between a military government, which I don't think anybody particularly wants, although they're the only thing they have, or alternatively, civilian kleptocratic governments. And they've gone back and forth between the two. But given its feudal nature and how many votes are delivered in this feudal way, how do you really get to the heart of how people think and feel in that country? Or is it so corrupt and so controlled by the elite that nobody cares what the average Pakistani feels?
Well, you've asked about 10 questions in one.
So sorry.
Try to deal with the issues you raised. One of the issues you raised in that question is the tussle, the continual tension between civilian and military control, which is a permanent problem for Pakistan, largely because it's always been focused on its belief that India remains an existential threat to Pakistan. And so much of its focus has been on defending itself against the perceived threat from India rather than on developing its own nation economically and socially. And that's been a major problem. Another problem has been sort of what I call the curse of poor or failed leadership. Through its relatively brief history, Pakistan has suffered a series of catastrophes in terms of leadership. Some of its best leaders have been killed in office or died in office. Others have been taken over by military regimes. Others have simply proved incompetent to rule. And Pakistan really has never had a civilian government, or any government really, that has finished out its term in a peaceful succession. And there's hope that this time, even though the current government is not terribly popular, that if it does finish out its term and does hand over power peacefully to another government, that this alone would be an accomplishment. So the bar is quite low, actually. And Pakistan, again, its short history, has not really had a chance to develop the kind of mature political institutions that are needed for a thriving democracy.
But the feeling I get from your book, Pamela Constable, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself, is since you've profiled so many people, and particularly the vast majority are so poor, and they seem so disconnected from the elite, and we only deal with the elite and hear from the elite. And I'm wondering whether at the end of the day, the only thing that the poor have is Islam.
Well, that's a main a principal theme and point of my book, which is that, you know, many Pakistanis, and again, we're talking about a country of more than 175 million people, many Pakistanis feel very alienated from the state, do not feel represented or served or protected by the state, do not feel that their opportunities have been met by the state, are frustrated that they don't get enough education, can't find jobs, can't find the basic things they need. And so, yes, in many cases, you have people turning towards Islam, and particularly Sunni Islam, and increasingly more conservative or alarming versions of Sunni Islam to satisfy their needs.
And I take it that in terms of that, the more radical forms of Islam, you have to, I think, include surely the influence of the Saudi Arabians, don't you? Haven't they been funding I mean, I know the madrasa thing has been somewhat overplayed, but I believe that the Saudis have been funding both radicalism in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, for that matter.
Yes, this all really started with the Afghan wars against the Soviet Union in the 1980s, and of course the United States was heavily involved in that. But then after that war ended, the West pretty much withdrew from the region, and what was left in place was a much more radicalized, much more Middle Easternized infrastructure of Islamic mosques and seminaries and political parties that has been gaining influence ever since and is now giving the more moderate traditional forms of Islam a real run for their money in Pakistan.
So where do you see the lines, if you will, in terms of percentages? Or if I know it's not a very very useful thing, but I'm trying to get a handle on how small the elite is, how disconnected they are, what the percentage of the country that would be secular, that is modern, I know that you have they have freewheeling television, and some of it's quite racy and interesting. So there are these vast contradictions. I mean, when you think about that, and then you look at the video footage the other day of the Pakistan Taliban leader haranguing these poor hapless 16 police men before they were massacred. That's another side of it. So how do you give us a projection of the relative balance between the secular and religious, between the elite and the vast majority?
Yeah, again, you're raising some complicated issues with many aspects in the same question. You know, you've got class divisions, you've got religious divisions, you've got ethnic and linguistic divisions. You've got a whole series of what sociologists and political scientists call cleavages in that society, all of which play upon each other. And essentially, you have a westernized elite that is not terribly concerned about the plight of the poor, and that has, you know, I think, neglected the poor at its own peril for a very long time. You have this rising, more radicalized group of parties and individuals and leaders that are, you know, having enormous influence on the thinking and feelings of the poor, who feel left out of the opportunities that a country like Pakistan ought to be able to provide. You have a number of different issues of ethnic violence. You have this growing demographic time bomb of a very fast growing population that cannot be supported much longer by the infrastructure and the economic size of the state. So you have, I guess, what you'd call sort of multiple crises coming closer and closer together, and I'm not sure that the leadership is really in a position, you know, to know what to do about this. I mean, it's of course there's corruption, there are a number of other problems, but the real issue is one of, you know, leaders rising to an occasion, confronting the issues that exist squarely, and calling on the nation to help them do something about it.
Well, of course, Pamela Constable, you can't help somebody who doesn't want to help themselves, and I suppose that raises the question about what the U.S. is doing, and we've concentrated on military aid. But then recently there was the Kerry-Lugar bill, but that was greeted in Pakistan, particularly by the ISI-influenced press, as some kind of encroachment by Blackwater, and all this hysteria went on. So one would not think on the American side they may feel like it's looking the gift horse in the mouth. But on the other hand, here in the United States, I think we could open up and buy some more of their cotton, and there's probably domestic political reasons why we don't. So what do you think in terms of the future? What can we do and what are we doing?
Well, again, you're asking so many
questions. Well, I'm trying to get everybody to understand what the book's about, and I'm trying to do it in a very quick and economical way.
I do appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say. I mean, there are issues of import tariffs on textiles and apparel. That's one issue right there with U.S.-Pakistan relations. There are the growing tensions between allied military and intelligence establishments that need to be somehow fixed. There's a great deal of mistrust now between these two allies that needs to somehow be repaired. But, you know, if there's one thing that I think really needs to happen on both sides of the aisle, you know, when people ask me what I think Pakistan needs most, I always say education, because if you can educate that populace, if you get people to have a clearer sense of their own opportunities and their own rights and their own capacities, that country can take off like a rocket. There's no reason that Pakistan should not be able to develop and progress at the pace of a Turkey or a Mexico or a Bangladesh or an India. There's just no reason that this can't happen, and it really should happen. And I think if there's anything that the West can do, aside from strict economic relations, it's to encourage the kind of exchanges that help people on both sides of the ocean have a clearer understanding of these misperceptions and the mistrust. I mean, Pakistanis, many, many, many Pakistanis really believe that the West is out to get them, is out to destroy their religion, their way of life, which I don't think is true, but it really needs to be challenged, and it really needs people really need to have a clearer understanding of what's at stake and who their friends are and who their enemies are.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Pamela Constable.
It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Pamela Constable, author of the new book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. Pamela Constable is a foreign correspondent and former deputy foreign editor for The Washington Post. She has covered South Asia from New Delhi to Kabul. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we went to London to speak with Jonathan Birdwell, who's a researcher in the Violence and Extremism Program at Demos in London. He's been doing a survey of the right-wing growth of right-wing movements in Europe and Western Europe, but also Eastern Europe. And unfortunately, it has become more palatable, some of their attitudes and expressions. Obviously, this mass murder in Norway may have set them back a little bit, but already they've got mainstream politicians like British Prime Minister Cameron and German Chancellor Merkel both recently proclaiming the death of multiculturalism. It makes you wonder whether any of these politicians have noticed their soccer teams, their national soccer teams, are examples of multiculturalism. However, it does give you some idea of how the right wing is resurgent, or these right wing groups are resurgent in European politics. So we were really trying to, with Jonathan Birdwell, get into the link between the resurgence of far right extremism and political violence. Clearly, the extra step that this Norwegian mass murderer took. And he got into some of the examples in this mass murderer's manifesto, which indicate, he referred to a lot of people over here in the United States, as a matter of fact, including the head of the United States Institute for Peace that George W. Bush appointed, Daniel Pipes, along with that horrible woman, Pamela Geller, of the so-called Ground Zero Mosque phony controversy that she ginned up. So it's a pretty tawdry bunch, and we can only hope that they are on their on their way out, even though the indications are that they're actually growing. We took this discussion further with Frank Schaefer, who's the son of one of the founders of the religious right. Of course, is broken with Falwell and Robinson, etc. And he really feels that there are real analogies with the religious right in this country. And he went on a tear about how much the Republicans really are captured by the religious right, and how they are extremists, and how that it's all my way or the highway, and that kind of zealotry and religious conviction and dogma are incompatible with politics, which are by nature about compromise. If you have God on your side and you obviously don't believe that you need to compromise, you just need to get rid of the devil. And the devil is all of us people who believe in women's choice and religious choice, including being atheists. So it was a pretty disturbing conversation. And finally, we talked with Pamela Constable, Washington Post correspondent, about her new book about Pakistan cracking up, Playing with Fire. That was a fascinating conversation. Of course, fascinating. It's always depressing. There's always some more bad news about Pakistan. But she really got into how the people of Pakistan feel. And it's definitely well worth a read to understand the people of this beleaguered country. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.